In a few moments, David Whetstone will come your way with We the People, so we hope you stay tuned. And, of course, following him today, every Wednesday, is Clarence the Blues Man Turner with Don't Forget the Blues. And, of course, at 1 p.m., Wiza Muntali and Africa Now, followed by Zain El Amin and Shaiwanana Mint and Tea in Arabic. So that's all here for you on WPFW. You are in tune to WPFW in Washington.
The king is dead. Greetings. WPFW is pleased to announce the relaunch of our major donor program, now known as the Jazz and Justice Circle. If you gave $1,000 last year or so far this year, you are automatically enrolled in this cherished group of listener members, and we thank you. Benefits of your membership are at wpfwfm.org under the Support Us tab at the top of the homepage is the Jazz and Justice Circle. Interested in joining this select group? Please consider a donation of $1,000 or more online at wpfwfm.org. Your donation helps WPFW build a better world one broadcast at a time.
And Charles, let me... And welcome to We the People. I'm your host, David Whetstone, right here on WPFW 89.3 FM, WPFWFM.org. Today, we'll take a look at the Wall Street Boy, Kip Kimboi. Can a young genius beat the global financial system of the stock market with his algorithm? And we'll look at the African Diaspora Film Festival. Our guest today, our film director, Charles Uwagabai, who will discuss his film as part of the upcoming festival. And he's an award-winning film director based in Ontario, Canada. For more than 10 years, he has presented creative works on various platforms such as Netflix, Amazon Prime, Canal Plus, and more. Our other guest is Diarra Ndaw Speck. She is the co-founder and co-director of the African Diaspora Film Festival that was established in 1993. She has served on juries of many international film festivals, including the 35th Durban International Film Festival and FESPACO, the Pan-African Film and Television Festival of Ouagadougou, Burkina Faso. ADIFF represents films that explore the human experience of people of color all over the world in order to inspire imaginations, disrupt stereotypes, and help transform attitudes that perpetuate injustice. Thank you both for being here this morning, and welcome.
Thank you for having us.
Charles, we're going to start out with you and discuss the film for the first half of our show. It was a pleasure to experience your work as a filmmaker. How did you come to your vocation, your profession?
Filmmaking for me started, first of all, hi, nice to be on the show. Filmmaking for me started as a means to tell stories. I had this passion for telling stories, and I really wanted to explore the African continent in terms of the stories that I grew up learning and grew up hearing and how, you know, it formed my life. So I wanted to share this experience with other people. So I got the passion for making films. And just found myself in the film industry and started growing until I became a director. I think I shot my first film in 2010 as a director, and it's been a journey since then.
I know that many people, particularly on the continent, but also here in the States, are familiar with a lot of your work. I wonder if you could just even tell us a little bit more about the different elements that you put in your films.
Okay, the kind of stories I like to tell, if given the chance, are the stories that show the influence of where I'm from. I'm from Nigeria, originally from Nigeria, but I live in Canada. There are a lot of African stories that talk about the people, the culture of the people, what we are as a people, who we are as a people, where we come from, our spirituality, our originality, our creativity. And those are the things that influence the kind of stories I tell, the positivity of Africa. You know, many times when we hear about Africa, we just think about the negative things and the war, the hunger, the stories that, you know, the people are from the forest or whatever, but it's beyond that. And those are the kind of things that I like to show when I tell my stories. Even when I make films that are shot in the Western world, like in Canada and the US, I want to talk about Africans. I want to talk about who we are, our strengths, what makes us, you know, what we are as a people. And those are things that influence the way I tell my stories.
Well, let's get to your current film. It's a thriller. Yeah. It's a thriller of a different sort. How did the story come to you? What arrested your interest, and how did you pursue the development of the movie?
Okay, I didn't write The Wall Street Boy. A friend of mine, Joel Richardson, wrote the film. So Joel's the white guy. He's been going to Kenya since over 30 years. He's a runner. He used to run like for the country and all of that. So he made friends with this Kenyan gold medalist who lives in a small village called Metipso in the uplands at the border of Kenya. So Joe would always say that, you know, Metipso saved my life because of the connection with his friend in Kenya. He became a better person and became who he is today. So he's always wanted to give back and to tell the world what joy it is to know a place called a small village and to know people from a small town who had influenced his life in a very positive way. So he came up with the idea to write a script, and not just any script, just to tell a story about how positive it is, you know, how a small town village could have impacted him so much. So he came up with this script called Kip Ken Boy, about a small math genius, which we made into the movie called The Wall Street Boy today. It's about a young math genius from a small village who created an algorithm that would shake the world, basically. So when I read the script, it just tied with the things that I like and my values that I hold strong, and I really wanted to be a part of it. So from when I got the script to when we make it, it was about a year and a half, or let's say just, and up to now it's about two and a half years already. So we started, I read the draft of the script that he sent to me. I put in my inputs, and then we went to set and we came up with this beautiful piece that everybody's talking about today.
Right. And I understand that commitment took 7 years. What went into those 7 years?
Basically writing the story, writing the story, getting funding and all of that. It takes a while to make a good film.
Yes, it does.
Yeah.
There's a uniqueness to the film. Not only the storytelling that you mentioned, but the cinematography, the motion, the progression of the film. It really refreshes a perspective or an understanding of Kenya and of Africa. Can you give maybe the listeners some sort of sense, not only oral, but visual, of what you were trying to do?
Yes. So two things that I'll say is, first of all, when I went to that village for the first time, one of the things that drew my attention was how beautiful the place is, how magical it was. You know, it's really on the highlands, and you find runners and all the sports people go there to practice because the air is kind of thin there. If you practice and you can do well there, so you can run anywhere. In the mornings, it's just beautiful. It's breathtaking. You really can't describe what you feel and what you hear from the sounds, or from the forest to the small towns, and it's just magical. That's the word I'll use to describe it. And I really wanted to depict that in the pictures, in the way I showed the landscape and the way I showed the towns and the villages and the community around, you know, all of the spaces. So I think I tried and trying to show it visually. I don't know if I did justice to it because it's not something I can explain. You just have to experience Kenya for yourself.
I think you succeeded on two counts though.
Yeah.
Even if one's not a naturalist, you need to embrace the nature that you see before you in the film. And also, there seems to be a more intimate connection between the rural and the urban.
Exactly. There is a connection between, because a lot of people live in small communities around the major cities, just like we do here. So there's Toronto and there's Ajax and like smaller cities around the main city. And then we all in the morning go to Toronto to work and then drive back through the traffic in the evenings, you know. So it's pretty much the same thing. You know, there's a big city where they have the banks and, you know, all the big institutions, and then they go back to the smaller towns, communities at the end of the day. So that I think I expressed in the film. And the beauty and the lifestyle of the people, how they interact, how they do business, how they communicate, the communal living, you know, the love that they share. You know, it's almost impossible not to have that communal living in Africa. People live together. People respect each other. People love each other. You know, they say your kids are my kids, your family are my family. That's how they pretty much live and associate. So that family unit, that's the strength in communal living. It's really emphasized, and it's something I wanted to also show in the film as well.
Allow me to reintroduce you. We're talking to filmmaker, film director, Charles Uwagbai.
Uwagbai, perfect.
Uwagbai, thank you. I've been trying hard to make sure I hit the mark there, sir. And we're talking about his film, The Wall Street Boy, Kip Kimboy. And it's part of a festival here in Washington, D.C. Let's get into the plot. Tell us about these two powerful protagonists of your movie.
Okay, without trying to spoil the film,
sure.
I'll just say the film, you know, embraces the friendship of these two young friends. One's a math genius, and his girlfriend, who's like a support character and a strong motivation, you know, for him. I'm trying not to spoil this film, but yeah, there's just this friendship that they hold. And you should see, and you really enjoy.
Okay. Well, you're being modest, and I want to keep to your promise of not giving away the film. But the two main characters are incredibly, incredibly intelligent. It's no overstatement to say they both reflect genius. The title character, especially so. And They have an involuntary adventure. The world comes to them, so to speak.
Exactly.
I mentioned in the intro what the element of the thriller is. There are all sorts of connections here. You talked about what made up the film. There's a sense of not only their relationship, the trust, the friendship, the integrity, but the families and the communities and the settings that they're in. Once they make a discovery, how does that all come to play, particularly with the community?
So naturally, growing up as a young boy in Africa, there is a sense of, I don't know if it still applies these days because the world is becoming more ugly. There's a sense of belonging, a sense of responsibility to your community, to your people. I'll give an instance. If a young man just comes home with $1 million, the family is not going to just embrace that money. They're going to ask you, where did you get this from? You know, where is it coming from? How did you make this money? Is it legitimate? You know, they want to test the integrity of purpose, of and not just being wealthy or being famous or just getting it, but they want to test that what you're doing is legit and you're not going to get into any kind of trouble or drag. I think that they were more interested in the values, integrity of the people than holding the family's name and culture and esteem than just, you know, making it in life like it is today. You know, and that's what we kind of reflected in the story, that we show that there are still good people. It doesn't matter where you're from. It doesn't matter where you're from. You can make a change. You make a positive change to the world. And that's what we try to reflect in the story, which is why I pretty much like the story a lot.
What reinforces that theme is a sense of the collective.
Yeah.
Even though they're trying to escape danger, they're not alone. And you talked about a sense of accountability that our young main character has. Mm-hmm. I hope you could describe a little bit more how not only was he responsible to his parents and to his girlfriend, but the elders of the village.
Yeah. I try not to spoil the story, so I'm just being careful what I say, because I want you to watch it. I want people to
Well, we want people to get a gist of that this young man is doing everything perfectly legal, but he's winding up in big trouble. That forces and powers are after him.
So the thing is that we already called this character Kip Kamboi, the Wall Street Boy. He's a genius, and he's created this algorithm that, you know, attracts the power shakers, the power holders of the financial market. And it's almost impossible not to get the attention that he's drawn to himself with that kind of power in his hands. And so you imagine that the whole world will come looking for him. Both the good and the bad guys will come searching, will come knocking. But it's amazing how this character is able to hold, you know, his esteem high and hold the values that he knows, and the support from the community, from his mom, from the his friend, his girlfriend, the villagers, the elders, the whole nation at the point, you know, gave him this support. Once they knew that what he was doing was illegal, was legal, and he was in the right path, and he's trying to be cheated, you know, everyone stood up. Everyone that's supposed to stand up for him stood up for him, as against what would expect the world, you know, how the world to behave, you know, which is what makes this story very unique and very thought-provoking as well.
As we said earlier, the film speaks a lot of Africa, of the continent, but also the diaspora. Is it fair to say that the film's deliberately Pan-African in its operation?
Yeah, I'll say the film is Pan-African in a way. It's actually a global concept. It's something that anybody anywhere would understand, and not just within Africa, because it talks about. There's one analogy I always do when I was making the film. I would get a picture of the what I thought the because he made it like a satellite tower beside the hut. I'll get a picture of that, what I felt that picture, that tower would look like, and I'll get a picture of what a tower in New York would look like, and I'll put them side by side, and I'll just stare and look at that image. And it kind of made me feel like, yeah, you might be in a small little community, but we're all in the same world. We're all chasing the same goals, you know, and that kind of made me understand that anybody anywhere would watch this movie and understand it. There's a particular scene in the film where I took a shot where he came to the big city in Nairobi for the first time, and he stood in front of that newsroom, and he looked up and saw the tower on top of that building, and it just made him. I took a very unique shot in that. If you when you watch the film, you see, and he just looked at that tower, and he felt some kind of way. As an audience, I wanted the people to feel that kind of way as well when you watch the film, and I hope I did that, because you then realize that, okay, yeah, I'm facing something way bigger than expected. I started a chain of reaction that I can't probably stop right now. So that's what I try to show.
Yes, I believe you succeeded in that, sir. So often, particularly here in the States, we don't have a picture of really massive, complex urban cities that populate the continent. Mm-hmm. And I think your film does a pretty good job of bringing us an understanding that there are major urban centers throughout the continent.
Yeah.
Another exceptional thing of note is the agency of women in the film. Again, I'm not prompting you to give away the story, but as best you can, it just seems indisputable that women have their own strong identity, their own agency.
Yeah.
And they're more than just a mere complement to the men in their lives or to the villages and towns that they live in.
Yeah. So women are very strong, very important part of our community today. Sometimes we don't like to talk about it. You know, we always feel like Africans are a patriotic society. But yeah, women are very important and are very strong. And I try to also depict that in the story. by giving key characters, very key characters, the roles of women. Again, I don't want to spoil the film, but you would see some characters that you would have imagined that this could be a guy, or this could have been a man, but it's a woman, you know. And it was deliberate, really deliberate. We played in a festival in LA earlier this year, and that was one of the things that, you know, was really a strong factor in the selection process and the people just appraising the film, just basically because they saw women in a different light, and they saw women holding strong positions. You know, today we have the one of the candidates for the presidency of the United States. It's a woman, and people are already saying, yeah, we're probably going to have our first female president with Kamala, and, you know, and the world is evolving. So we need to show this. We need to show that it doesn't matter your sex or your gender or, you know, where you're from, you know, you can be what you want to be. You can change the world. You can impact the world. Yeah. So you need to see The Wall Street Boy, Kip Kamboy. You need to see the film and be the judge for yourself.
All right. Well, to give you the last word, sir, you mentioned that the world's ever changing.
Yeah.
You're encouraging us about your film, but I'm mindful that, you know, 25% of the African continent is populated by people who are under 25 years of age. Oh. So there's obviously, both contained in the film and in your concerns, what's the future hope that you have, whether it's with the audience or with what you want your work to contribute to?
Yeah, you're right. The world is, the higher population of the world, especially in Africa today, are younger people, maybe under the age of 25 or 30 years old, and they hold a greater population of the grand population of the larger population in Africa. And these are people that are doing things. These are people that are creating marks. These are people that are impacting the world in whatever space, be it sports, in entertainment, in IT, in whatever, you know. I really want to impact these people, to talk to these people, to challenge them, to challenge Africans, that, you know, we can make the mark. We can be the people that we are. We can represent our culture, our heritage. We can win. You know, it doesn't mean because we're Blacks or we're from Africa, we're from a small town or a small village or a woman or whatever. You can be the change that you want.
Well, thank you, Charles Ogwagbai. Thank you for being part of the ADIFF this year. All the best with your future work, and thank you for what you've given us thus far.
Thank you so much. Thank you.
Coming up next, we'll talk to Diarra Ndaw Speck, the co-founder and co-director of the African Diaspora Film Festival, after these public service announcements.
Equal Portions is delighted to join Jazz and Justice Radio, WPFW, every Monday at 1 p.m. beginning August 5th. We're talking everything food justice, interviewing folks across all sectors, and playing the hottest new DMV music with your host, Seisha Lamira.
Hey, y'all. On Equal Portions, we'll be discussing all aspects of the way we interact with food, from the problems affecting our communities to the history and the story of the food around us and the local individuals within the food community. That's Equal Portions, Mondays at 1 p.m. on WPFW, building a better world, one broadcast at a time.
Hi, this is Jim Byers, host of the Latin Flavor Classic Edition. Support from listeners like you are the tools that have built WPFW over nearly five decades. We provide news, music worth listening to, and in-depth conversations about your community and the world. One of the many ways you can contribute is to donate a vehicle that you no longer need. Running or not, it can do wonders for WPFW. So donate it for a tax break for 2024. Go to WPFWFM.org or call 1-866-WPFW-CAR. That's 1-866-973-9227 for more information. Help WPFW continue building a better world, one broadcast at a time.
And welcome back to We the People. I'm your host, David Whetstone, right here on WPFW 89.3 FM, WPFWFM.org, Pacifica Foundation Radio, emanating from Washington, D.C., 50,000 watts strong, over 47 years old, because you, the listener, choose to support our station, both with your finances and your social connectivity. I join with the staff and other programmers, and thank you for that. We're here bringing you Jazz and Justice, programs of public affairs, cultural interest, news, and of course, jazz, world beat, even some hip hop. And all that is to build a better world, one broadcast at a time. Joining me is Deira Endow Speck. She is a co-partner along with Ronaldo Barroso Speck. She's the co-founder and co-director of the African Diaspora International Film Festival. Thank you for being with us this morning. I know the festival has been...
Yes. Go ahead.
So once again, welcome to Washington. I know you had your start in 1993. I don't know how many years of that you've been in Washington, D.C., but again, welcome.
Thank you. Thank you. We've been in Washington, D.C. for 17 years now. And so the festival this year is going to be held at George Washington University at the Amphitheater. It starts on Friday, this Friday, August the 2nd until the 4th. So it's a whole weekend of wonderful films. And if people are curious, they can go to our website, nyadiff.org, to look up the lineup.
Oh, well, the lineup represents 17 films. They cover individuals like James Baldwin, Claude McKay, Mary Church Terrell, Mary Gela, the Brazilian poet and activist. They cover locales like Burkina Faso, Brazil, Cuba, even San Antonio, Texas. And the topics are things like criminal justice, voting rights, wow, colorism, the identity and struggles and lives of Afro-Latinas. So I think I did a good job with that. You can dig in a little further as we talk. But to give people some sense of how these things come together and what kind of individuals put these things together, tell us of your own background that led to film and media.
Sure. So my name is Deira Endow Speck. I was born in France. So my father is from Mali and my mother is French. And they met in the 50s when my father was still a subject of France. He was a colonial subject of, at the time, French Sudan. And it was very unusual to have mixed couples in France at the time. So, but they had something in common. They really loved art. And I think they connect, you know, they gave me that love for art and culture. So in the 80s, I met my husband, Ronaldo Barroso Speck, in France, and we came in the early 80s to the US, and we also had this common interest in arts and culture. And so we connected through that. And in fact, I remember in the late 80s, we used to go to the Montreal Film Festival in Montreal just for fun to watch films during the summer vacations. And we would like watch five films per day. That was how we spent our time and enjoyed ourselves. In terms of my academic training, I have a bachelor's degree in economics and an MBA from Columbia University in marketing and management. And I have taken a couple of film courses, but I come to the film and media space more from a business perspective. And my husband, who is a doctoral, he has a degree in education, a doctoral degree in education. He comes to films from an educational and cultural perspective. So we have
He's a filmmaker per se, right?
No, he's not a filmmaker. He's an educator.
Sorry.
No, he's an educator. Okay. He's teaching foreign languages, and he's used films in the classroom to teach foreign languages. So we have combined our skills and interests, and we created the film festival in 1993 in New York. And today the festival travels in Washington, D.C., in Chicago, in Paris, France, and in New York City. And we've been doing this for the last 32 years.
And I tried in the introduction to give some people an idea of purpose and mission. But since we have you with us, state the mission and all the underpinnings that you want us to know about the festival.
Sure. What is important is that when we first came to the U.S., we realized that there was not a lot of films about the human experience of people of color, not just African-American, but also Afro-European, Afro-Latino. And so we kind of realized that the festival could be a way for us to challenge stereotypes, to inspire imaginations, to help discussions about social justice. And the festival for us is like a bridge across communities. We offer thought-provoking content, from documentaries to fiction, and we want to connect audiences from, you know, that have an interest in the African diaspora, as well as, you know, people from all genre, you know, people of all races, of all ages, of all, you know, sexes, who actually have an interest in good films and want to learn about the African, the Black experience in the world. So our mission is really to foster more understanding of the global Black experience and the global, you know, the our richness and diversity as Black people all over the world.
And I mentioned a synopsis at the beginning of this segment, but why don't you have the audience dig in a little further and tell us some more specifics?
Sure. So we are talking about the African Diaspora International Film Festival, the 17th edition that's going to be held at George Washington University. And again, I want to invite people to follow with me on the website at nyadiff.org if they want more information about the festival. And earlier you were talking about women, you know, the importance of women in the Wall Street Boy. And in fact, I want to highlight the fact that over 50% of the selection in the festival this year is directed by women. So we have, you know, documentaries. I want to speak, for example, about Mother Suriname, which is a film that will screen on Friday. That is a beautiful narration of the history and contribution of simple women from Suriname over a span of time. So the director speaks about her grandmother, who is a washerwoman, and she gives her a voice. And this woman describes how she lived under colonial time and then under independence. And the filmmaker uses archival footage in order to tell the story, and she colorized it. So it's also artistically a beautiful piece of work. Our opening night film is also directed by a woman, and it's called Breaking Boundaries. And it's about Natasha Generalova, who is the daughter of a Russian mother and an African-American father. And she's part of Team USA in rhythmic gymnastics, which is a primarily white sport. So she's breaking boundaries in the sense that she's one of the first Black sportswoman to be part of Team USA in that particular sport. And the film follows her as she tries to qualify to participate in the Olympics in 2020. And so the director takes us by the hand and shows us the life of Natasha, the difficulties she faces, her successes, and the moments of happiness and frustration, and how she evolves, you know, over time, and as the only Black person in her sport. And Natasha is actually coming to DC. So she will be attending. She will be there to talk about her experience, about what it means, what it takes to be like the top-notch sports person in terms of the brain work that needs to be done to be able to concentrate and achieve that level of success. And we also have a reception, etc. So it's like a nice way to start the festival with a great film and great story and a great chance to have conversation.
And, yes.
Yeah, go ahead.
No, as you were talking, I was thinking of Ms. Biles. and the fact that here's an early precursor of
gymnastics excellence.
Yeah, absolutely. In fact, I was thinking of her too, but Nastasha is a person on her own because she also speaks Russian. Her mother is Russian. So she started doing rhythmic gymnastics at a very young age. And she's also representative of the new American, the new Black American experience. You know, what it means to be American today. You know, you can think of Kamala Harris, Obama. We are all Americans, but we represent a very global and international way of being part of the Black experience. And that's what the festival represents, really, and tries to convey.
Yes. We still have a few more moments before our next break. Tell us some more about, I'm particularly intrigued with the social justice themes that are represented this year in the festival.
Yeah, we have several very important films. So we have a Fighting White Supremacy in Brazil program. Now, there is a long legacy of racism in Latin America, and that's a topic that is not necessarily addressed or understood very well. And so the Fighting White Supremacy in Brazil is presenting three films. The first one is called Marighella, you mentioned earlier, who was a poet and an activist who fought against the erosion of civil rights during the dictatorship in Brazil in the 60s. And he was really an urban guerrilla fighter who was who took arms against the government and was researched by the CIA. So it's an action, it's a thriller, the lead, but it's a very powerful film. At the same time, it gives you a lot of historical background. Then we have the second film in that program is called Role, Stories of Brazilian Protest in Malls. And what this is interesting is, as part of this notion of denial of civil rights and discrimination in Brazil, one of the things that happens is Brazilians, Black Brazilians, are not allowed to enter malls.
Shopping malls.
Shopping malls, which is, you know, so they are kept in places. It's almost like a small, one way, it's a little bit like apartheid. And so what they do, these young people, they revolt. And the way they revolt is actually go into malls in large numbers and they protest in malls. They do performances, they do music, and they disrupt the space, the spaces. And
could so I add, also, and I believe the film demonstrates this.
Yeah,
Private security, it's oxymoronic, has been the cause of many injuries and deaths. Yeah. So it's not a matter that they're just having a bad day and decide to raise trouble. They've actually been victimized
completely
in this process, and this is their response.
That's their response. So it's a nonviolent response against discrimination, and we follow three activists who, especially women are very active in this movement. And so the documentary talks about that experience. And the third film is called Power Alley. This is actually one of several films that have been presented in major film festivals internationally. Power Alley was part of A Certain Regard Cannes Film Festival in 2023. Another film that was in the Cannes Film Festival last year also we are presenting this weekend is called Nome from Guinea-Bissau. And we also have Marighella was at the Berlinale Film Festival. We also have a classic Business, which was at the Cannes Film Festival. So to say that some of the films presented in the festival are actually recognized by internationally as some of the best film that you would want to see, you know, if you're a cinephile, if you want to be exposed to these films. So the films present both high production value and strong storytelling, as well as important messages.
And you mentioned classic films and important films in the history and landscape of film. Isn't there a contribution by the Cuban, Afro-Cuban director, Sergio Giral?
Yes, Sergio Giral. He actually passed away recently, so we wanted to honor his legacy by screening the film Maluala, which is set in 19th century Cuba and talks about the runaway enslaved Africans who were called Cimarrones, who hide in the settlements in the eastern mountains, and how they interact with the people in the power in place in order to maintain their autonomy and freedom within the context of the Cuban society. Very revealing and important. We have Fighting White Supremacy, the African-American Experience, a program of shorts, all directed by women, again, so including the one you mentioned earlier about the suffragettes, and then How to Get Free, which is a documentary that talks about the bail system and how, you know, it impacts.
How we get free.
We get free. And then Judging Juries, which is a very interesting short about the lack of representation in jury pools today, and explores the reason why that's happening. And all these films illustrate how we can fight black supremacy by reforming bills, by participating in juries, and by manifesting in order to have, and by exercising our rights to vote. You know, so all of those are films that are in that package. We have a colorism in Latino communities discussion, again, focusing now on Latin America and the issue of colorism in Black and Indigenous community.
Particularly how it affects women, right?
Yes. And we'll have a discussion with the director, will be in attendance for that. And Dr. Spech, who is Afro-Latino, will bring us some historical and political perspective on the issue. So that's going to be also a very interesting presentation. We have a documentary about Claude McKay, From Harlem to Marseille, which reveals not only his work as a poet, but also his life story that I think people don't know much about him as an individual. And
The Jamaican-American writer.
Right.
Part of the Harlem Renaissance, yes.
Part of the Harlem Renaissance. So it's a very, you know, it's a beautiful documentary that talks about his work as a writer. It uses music, jazz music. It uses lots of historical footage. He contextualizes his life in the 1920s, Harlem Renaissance. Then he lived in France for many years. He went to Russia. It's interesting to see the lack of a black intellectual who was marginalized because he didn't fit any criteria. And he actually had a strong interest in giving a voice to the marginals, to the poor people, to the people who were, to the black people. In France, he lived with in Marseille, in the ports, and he describes that in his books. And all of that is in the film. So it's wonderful. The Wall Street Boy, I highly recommend it. Please come out. You just heard Charles talk about it. It's a wonderful, wonderful, uplifting story, thriller, fun and revealing and very interesting. We have I Heard It Through the Grapevine about James Baldwin. It's not about James Baldwin. It's actually James Baldwin going back to places in the South during the civic that were important during the civil rights movement. And he goes back in the 80s. So it's like multi-layered because we are in 2024. We see him reflect in the 80s of the progress of the Black experience from the 60s. And so it's a whole journey, and it's a restored copy.
Of a classic documentary.
Yeah.
I understand not only does he talk about the trip and it's a reflection on the trip, but he sits down with authors like Amiri Baraka, and I'm trying to think of who else I can't remember right now. I want to.
There's Amiri Baraka. Okay. There's, I think there's Shinra Achebe is there, and there's a few other important people.
Yeah, Achebe and Baraka seem to be the two I remember right now. Yeah. So he reflects with other Black authors his experience. So the audience gets a sense of unfolding, not only the personal experience, but what Black writers do in their observations of the world.
That's true. And he also goes back to places like he goes to Newark, and he reflects on what happened there and what's going on today. I mean, today, there today, which is in the 80s. And so it's very interesting because we see the evolution of the reflection on the evolution of society, what changed, what didn't change, and we can compare that to what changed today as well. And what didn't change today as well. And the closing film is very important. It's called One Person, One Vote. And it talks about the Electoral College. It gives us a history of the creation of the Electoral College, which actually is rooted into slavery. And most people don't know that. And so the director will be in attendance, and there will be a discussion about the importance of the Electoral College today, its history, and what is being done for maybe that system to change in the future.
Well, allow me to, I've been neglecting some housekeeping here. I want to remind people that are listening to We the People. I'm your host, David Whetstone. More importantly, have been my guest. Presently talking is Deira Ndah Speck. She is the co-founder and co-director of the African Diaspora Film Festival.
It's the African Diaspora International.
How dare I forget the international?
Yeah. And it's in it's coming up this weekend at George Washington University. And if you want more information, you can go to our website, nyadiff.org.
Well, I want to begin giving you a note of thanks, you and Charles Uwakbai. It's good that we have these cultural opportunities, and more importantly, the dedication of individuals bringing these things to us over and over again. There's a rich offering in what you've described. You've done this year after year. What are the lasting effects you want for those who attend?
I think, and I speak for myself, being able to be exposed to films and to stories and to spaces and to ideas that you're not necessarily familiar with, it really opens up your world. And what I'm hoping is that maybe there will be one sentence in one film that will trigger something in the person in the house and will say, oh, maybe I need to rethink something. Maybe I need to reflect. I need to research. I need to, it's like a way to opening up your world to more, to the richness and diversity of the Black experience. And I just want people to enjoy themselves and at the same time discover something new. You know, some folks, and I am one of those who actually tries to learn something new every day. And if you're one of these persons, the festival is definitely for you.
Well, you said that, and I hope the audience caught on that there are many facilitators, like the Claude McKay film. Keita Swan is doing a presentation along with that film. He says Africana and historian at George Washington University. And you talked about the steady pursuit of knowledge and expanding your world.
Yeah.
And I know that your website has not only the present offerings, but the past offerings and other references and things.
True. And so talking about the website, it is nyadiff.org. That stands for New York African Diaspora International Film Festival.
Where you're based.
Yeah, yes. Where we're based, nyadiff.org.
Well, again, our time has gone by very quickly, and I thank you for being with us this morning in this broadcast.
Thank you for having us.
All right. Take good care. All the best to you with your efforts.
Thank you.
Coming up next at 3:00, Sophie's Parlor. Music and culture by women, but for everyone. At 2:00, Shai Iwanana with Zen El Amin covering Middle Eastern affairs. Africa Now with host Moisa Mutali is broadcast at 1 p.m. on Wednesdays. And every noontime throughout the week, don't forget the blues. The Wednesday edition comes to you at noon from Clarence the Bluesman Turner. My thanks to Kalia Engineer and to the News and Public Affairs Departments of WPFW. Coming up next, 5 minutes before the hour, is the news. I believe either Chris Banger Drowns will bring it to you or Sue Goodwin. Again, listeners, thanks for being with us. Please tell others about this show and other shows on WPFW, and thank you for your support. Take care.
For WPFW News in Washington and WBAI in New York, I'm Sue Goodwin. Here are some headlines. Hamas political leader Ismail Haniyeh was killed early today after attending the inauguration of Iran's new president in Tehran. Hamas and Iran both blamed Israel, while the Israeli military declined to comment. His death threatens to deepen the war in Gaza to a region-wide conflict and raises fresh doubts about Gaza ceasefire talks underway in Rome. Iran's supreme leader said it was his country's duty to avenge the killing because it occurred in the Iranian capital, and Hamas's armed wing warned of major repercussions. Jordan, Lebanon, and Qatar condemned the killing of Haniyeh. Jordan said the killing will lead to more tension and chaos in the region, while Qatar described it as a heinous crime, a dangerous escalation, and a flagrant violation of international and humanitarian law. In other news, in a report released today, the Office of the United Nations High Commissioner for Human Rights said thousands of Palestinians have been detained by Israel in violation of international human rights and humanitarian law. The report said Israel's prison service held more than 9,400 detainees as of the end of June, and some have been held in secret without access to lawyers or respect for their legal rights. They are mostly men and boys, but some women and girls as well. Among them are doctors, journalists, and human rights defenders. The report, based on interviews with former detainees and other sources, also includes allegations of torture, such as waterboarding, sleep deprivation, and electric shocks. UN Human Rights Chief Volker Türk said in a statement that international humanitarian law protects all detainees and requires that they be treated humanely and protected from all acts of violence and threats of violence. In domestic news, the Senate yesterday overwhelmingly passed a pair of children's online safety bills. One of those bills, the Children and Teens Online Privacy Protection Act, would prohibit social media companies from collecting the personal data of kids for the purpose of targeted marketing. The second bill, the Kids Online Safety Act, also known as COSA, would make platforms liable for the content they show minors by legally requiring digital companies to protect youth from exposure to what the bill describes as harmful content. COSA faces continued opposition from a variety of civil liberties and human rights groups who warn that the bill could lead to government censorship on ideological grounds. The legislation now goes to the House, where its fate is uncertain. And at least 973 Native American children died in the U.S. government's abusive boarding school system, according to the results of an investigation released yesterday by the U.S. Department of the Interior. The report concludes a three-year investigation that saw, for the first time, the federal government accepting responsibility for its role in creating the system, which included more than 400 schools across 37 states. The report calculates that the federal government spent the equivalent